So thanks again for inviting me to Perimeter. It's very nice to be here, especially just with these last few days being beautiful weather and wonderful food on the ground floor and all these things that, we don't normally get in the normal university world. So I'm gonna move over a little bit. So today I want to talk about the Drake equation. Now, if all of you were at my talk yesterday, I apologize because the next few slides are gonna be very repetitive. But I like doing it because A, I am a repetitive person. I am a repetitive person. And B, I think it's worth repeating. These things are worth repeating. So, of course, when we talk about indigenous peoples and stuff, it is important to note that indigenous peoples have been here on this land that we call Canada since time immemorial. And, for every person that might mean a different thing, because for a mathematician or physicist, immemorial does not have a whole lot of meaning. But that's, I think it's safe to assume tens of thousands of years. And living on this land for that long, sharing stories, sharing knowledges, day in and day out, night in, night out, you build an intimate relationship with the land and the place you are. And no matter where you are on this land, you're on indigenous territory. So here, I'm grateful to be speaking on the land of the Anishinaabe, the Neutrals, and the Haudenosaunee. When I'm home, the Mi'kma'ki and the now extinct Wiyotup. If I'm out west, Salish, and so on. But being on these lands means living under the sky for tens of thousands of years, watching the precession of the North Star, watching supernovae explode like the crab, and so on. But telling stories and building this knowledge of the repeating cycles in the night sky, whether it's motions of stars, planets, and so on. And being on this land, we're telling stories, we can explore the land we're on. So as I talked about yesterday, we tell stories, but they depend on the land. And so if we're in different parts of the world, our stories are going to change. If we're in, the far north, we will tell a story about the Big Dipper or Orion. We probably won't tell many stories about the North Star because North Star being directly overhead isn't that useful, particularly for navigation. But if we're in Australia, we're also probably not going to talk about the North Star because it's below the horizon. We'll tell stories about the Cross or the Pleiades or the Canoeist, which in the north would be Orion's Belt. But these stories change. And they relate to how we view the night sky and the world around, or the space around us. So even the moon has a very different look and a very different set of stories. And what this helps us understand is that there are a number of axioms or methodologies that indigenous peoples can use that doesn't necessarily appear in the Western canon. And, before going too deep about this, I always want to make sure and highlight this over and over again that there is no one pan-Indigenous system. Indigenous peoples around the world have different ways of understanding nature and the world around them. If you're in Hawaii, you have one understanding. If you're in southern US, another understanding. If you're in Chile, if you're Incan, you have another understanding, etc. And so some of the axioms that are very important, as noted in the story, the sky above reflects the land below. For instance, the Lakota people, the night sky is a literal map, Black Mountains and the lands around them. Knowledge is a relationship. It's not something we obtain, we score. It's not something that, we can put in a box. It's our actions. It's what we do with it. Knowledge is something you do, not something you have. Multiple variables, which I mentioned yesterday, so I won't repeat the story about the caribou. Holistic knowledge. And again, one of the most important things is the idea that nature is familial. Not just holy and sacred, but familial, like we're related to it. And that will come up again when I talk about the Drake equation. But, when we talk about stories, I always tell this story from where I'm from. It's one of my few connections to Mi'kmaq astronomy. So I'm going to tell it again, because as I said yesterday, I can't. And but I can't tell it without Ojibwe. So Muin as you may know, is the Big Dipper. These four stars are the Bear, and Robin is the First Star Hunter, then Chickadee, and Gray Jay, and Passenger Pigeon, Blue Jay, Barn Owl, Sahuet Owl. And we tell this story throughout the year, not over one night. It's not like the Ursa Major, which is Zeus throwing the bear in the sky, and it doesn't matter when you watch it. When you watch the constellation Moon, it matters the timing. We tell the story about 5 a.m. or so, really early or really late, depending on the night before. And, you know, we tell that story because that changes, the position of the Big Dipper changes throughout the night. So we have to always make sure to tell it at the same time. And we tell the story throughout the year. We start in the spring when Muin is waking from hibernation. Muin is hungry. You know, you sleep for months on end and see how you feel when you wake up. Muin emerges from her cave, starts looking for food, when spotted by Robin. Robin knows Muin will provide food for people, for their sustenance, grease to help protect their homes and tools and medicine and so on. So Robin calls his friends. Chickadee comes behind with his pot, and you can see in here, Chickadee is two stars. And followed by Gray Jay, followed by Passenger Pigeon, followed Blue Jay and the Owls. And this is a very important part of our story because the Passenger Pigeon doesn't exist today. So this is partly one of the ways we honor Passenger Pigeon. Passenger Pigeon was driven to extinction almost over a century ago. But the hunt goes on. And as you get to the summer, Muin is crossing the land, evading the hunters. But Robin is trying to keep up. The other birds following behind. The long summer passes through the heat, the berries, picking berries, looking for food, medicines in the leaves, and so on. As we get to the fall, Muin is tired. Muin is frustrated. Muin is getting angry. So Muin gets on the hind legs and growls. Now, luckily, Muin is a black bear, so black bear on hind legs is about this big. Not scary, yes, but, you know, manageable. Well, maybe not for me. I'm more dangerous to myself in nature. And Muin's on his hind legs growling. Robin fires his arrow, striking Muin in the chest. And I shouldn't have done that. I just hit the mic. And Muin dies. Blood goes everywhere, covering Robin in that blood, staining him red. Robin flies into the trees to shake it off, staining all the leaves around him red, indicating fall, except for the one spot on the breast of Robin. Muin dies. Chickadee comes with his pot, begin sharing the food, cooking, celebrating a meal. The other birds join where they start dancing, telling stories, and they continue throughout the winter, as Muin is on her back, waiting for the spring. And when spring arrives, the story renews and goes on again. But the story is important because it contains lessons, it contains knowledge, it contains science, it contains wisdom. It is a part of understanding the land and the people and everything around us. And if we go back to looking at these axioms, you can think of what it means, right? What's above reflects below. Well, the story of Muin is about a hunt, the rules of the hunt. Like, you don't hunt the bear in the spring or the summer because that's when bears are mating, when bears are raising cubs. You hunt them in the fall. It tells us all these different things, and we can come up with different lessons from this story. You know, one is life is cyclical. The bear lives throughout the year. It tells us when to hunt the bears. It tells us about sharing a community. Not only, so we're not learning about the land, we're learning about ethics and morality. It points out the guide stars, because the stars are going around Datapin, the North Star. So there's a guide star and a navigational element. It tells us about the circumpolar stars. In the fall, as you get towards the fall, the owls in the hunt have fallen away because they're below the horizon. So you dictate the difference between circumpolar and non-circumpolar stars, and so on. And it tells us about the nature of birds and bears and all these different things, which is, you know, tells us a lot about the land we're on. And this is important because I think it's valuable to say that embracing and respecting indigenous knowledges can only make us better scientists. You know, working in astronomy, Some of us are radio astronomers. Some of us are optical astronomers. Some of us work in X-rays. And we can have huge fights about which wavelength dependence is more important, but we're all pretty sure X-ray astronomers who deal in single-digit number of photons are probably left behind. Sorry, that was a bad attempt at an astronomy joke. But when we use all these different wavelengths together, we get greater and deeper knowledge of phenomena in space. And it's very similar to the ideas of how we understand indigenous knowledge. Indigenous knowledge, working with Western knowledge, can come together and create a more detailed picture of phenomenon. And so this is the idea of two-eyed seeing, which was developed and shared by elders Albert Marshall and his wife, Mardina Marshall. And this idea, which is fairly straightforward, one lens, one way we view the world is through Western science, one lens through indigenous knowledge. And you know, for all those us with glasses, we know that when we have two lenses together, we get a deeper picture, a deeper sense. And trying to do this as bringing indigenous knowledge and Western science as two equal partners is a way forward in medicine, astronomy, physics, environmental science, and so on. And so in this talk today, I'm going to try to convince you that we can use indigenous knowledge to understand the Drake equation. Largely because we're going to exploit the differences between the indigenous knowledges versus ideas of what Western knowledge is. Now, we can all argue and debate what Western knowledge really implies, but I think, you know, when we talk about Western science, we talk about knowledge being objective. You do an experiment, you should be able to repeat that experiment. If you do see an observation, you should be able to verify that observation. The idea of being objective is that it doesn't matter who's looking. That truth is absolute, so on. That objectivity is not necessarily common for many indigenous peoples. Truth is relative to whoever, to the observer. We also, I think, in Western science, and what I think is probably most crass and contributes to things like climate change and environmental devastation, is the idea that nature is a hierarchy. Humans are on top of a pyramid, followed by animals, followed by fish, followed by plants, followed by dirt. I don't know whether or not we all think we feel this way. This idea really belongs in a lot of how we do science. Just think about how we do scientific testing or testing of medicine. We don't start by testing on people. We start by testing on mice because they're more expendable. And whether that's right or wrong is not for me to say, but it is what we do. So how do we take this and ask, what does it mean for the question of life in our universe? And I'm kind of giddy with the irony of talking about SETI and the Drake equation in the cosmology seminar. But I'm going to do my best. So just to remind everyone, I wasn't really sure how to pitch the level of this talk, so I just want to make sure I remind everyone. There are thousands of bloody planets known in our galaxy orbiting other stars. I'm old enough to remember when there was 9 planets known, then 8, then 1,000. The exponential rise is kind of mind-boggling. And we've only just scratched the surface. You know, in our map of our galaxy, almost all exoplanets are known in this small ring or circle around us. We've barely scratched the surface, dented, whatever you want to say, but we have so few or so little of our galaxy mapped for exoplanets. And unless we're in this really weird part of the galaxy, which may be possible if you talk about the galactic habitable zone and stuff like that, you know, there's planets everywhere. And this slide's already too old because that 4 should be a 5 or a 6 by now. But there are so many thousands of known exoplanets, and it's amazing. But of all these exoplanets, how many could have life? How many could have their own perimeter institute with someone standing there and saying, look at that yellow star. What are does that have life? Or does it have monkeys? Or hairless monkeys, which we are. And recently deceased, this question was really led by Frank Drake, who just passed away, leaving us a legacy that defined a field that people some joke about, people make movies about, some good, some bad movies, but it exists. And Frank Drake explored the question of how many civilizations might be in our galaxy. And he did this in a thought experiment, and really a kind of a clever thought experiment, because the Drake equation is really, in my mind, is less of an equation or mathematical idea, and more of just like trying to peel layers off an onion or something, or a Russian nesting doll. Because the idea is, you have, let's say there are N civilizations that you can communicate with, in his time, through radio signals. And he just basically said, well, let's look at it in our galaxy. There's 100 billion stars. There's probably about 3 solar masses worth born every year. So we need the star formation rate. So if there's 3 solar masses a year born every year, maybe 10 stars or 20 stars total. Then, well, of those stars that exist, how many have planets? So that's the next layer. Of the stars with planets, how many of those planets have the potential to support life? Now, whatever that means, I don't know. I think if we ever get to the point of understanding some of these things, we may find out that it's possible to have life without a planet. And so the whole thing goes out to lunch. But of the planets that could potentially support life, what is the fraction of planets that go on to actually support life? Of the fraction of planets that go on to support life, how many of those can support intelligent life? Of the fraction of those that support intelligent life, how many go on to build civilizations that can communicate or have a technology that is detectable from space? And Frank Drake, living probably one of the scariest times, I shouldn't call it scary times, but living in a time when people thought nuclear war was inevitable, he kind of assumed that technologies would probably self-destruct. Or at least become antiquated, so that maybe at some point they stop communicating technology. So Frank Drake added the length of time civilizations sort of live, or at least send detectable signals. So all this together gives us an estimate of the number of civilizations. Now the bright side, we know the star formation rate of our galaxy pretty well. We always throw out the number 3 solar masses a year, 3 suns, 30 odd M dwarfs, so on. The number of stars with planets, we know that now pretty well too. It's 20%. Go Kepler. The number of stars with planets that could potentially support life. Am I allowed to swear?
Sure.
No fucking clue. The fraction of those that could potentially support life, that go on to support life, well, if we have no clue but this one, guess what? We have no clue but that one. Intelligent life, we have no clue. We have no clue. We have no clue. Really. Unless you're so good at statistics, you can use a data point of 1 to create an average. And so, but Drake tried. We made some ideas and presented thoughts, and you get numbers. And typically, from the literature, the numbers that people kind of put out now are of order 10 in our galaxy. Largely because this ends up being a very small number for most people, a century or a millennia type in that range. And these are, you know, kind of small numbers. Maybe the potentially support life is about a handful, you know, per system. But it's very hard. And trying to do this is not easy because you have to come up with a definition of what does it mean to actually be a life? You know, when growing up, my brothers always tell me to get a life. I still don't know what that means. What does it mean to be an intelligent life? Well, that's a debatable question already, because there are people, it's arguable that there is no intelligent life on this planet. What does it mean to have a technology that's detectable from space? Well, we know that radio is detectable from space because we were stupid enough to send it out and realize that we were leaking radiation. And what is the length of time? Well, we picked length of time to be basically due to whether or not we're going to blow each other up with nuclear weapons in the 60s. Today, we might talk about, well, we're going to basically give ourselves heat stroke with climate change. Or what? But you know, the length of time is always superficial. And understanding these things is very difficult. You know, even just the understanding whether or not a planet can potentially support life is a problematic just idea. I mean, we typically think of, you know, a planet has to be in an orbit around its host star in such a way that water can exist as a liquid, solid, and gas simultaneously. You know, the Goldilocks zone. Well, guess what? She pissed off three bears, so it wasn't really that pleasant, now was it? So when we do this, we're kind of assuming something about life being on the surface of a planet, dictated by the temperature of the sun, and all these things. That's just one definition of habitability. Even our own solar system, habitability doesn't make sense because we go to Europa, which has salt water oceans under a shell of ice, which is probably a better place to have life. Maybe it's possible that depending, because the orbit of Pluto is so extreme, maybe it could produce liquid water at different times that has life. We don't know. So we're really just picking something, an idea, that's relative to what we understand about ourselves. And that's just for a planet being habitable. The big questions are, how do we define things like, what is life? What is intelligent life? What are civilizations? And lo and behold, that's not an easy question. I bet you we all have an idea what life is. Maybe life is DNA, RNA, single-celled organism. Sure. But when does that life become intelligent or civilizations? And in Drake's perspective, and I think many people in Western science, when we talk about intelligent life, we're talking about humans. Just humans. Not great apes, not elephants, not dogs, not cats. And that's actually a fairly modern definition. It wasn't much more than a century ago, people of other non-white races were not considered intelligent life. Our definition of intelligent is completely arbitrary. The idea of civilization is this. A city, cars, gas, planes, media, Instagram, TikTok. In which case, if we actually think TikTok is the example of civilization, then the length of civilization is hopefully much shorter than we expect. Sorry, I hate social media. But these issues exist. And if this is our definition of civilization, why? And we can go into more detail if we think about it from indigenous perspectives. As mentioned, we talk about life, which is fine. We'll leave life alone. Life is something that exists. We know when we see it. How do we deal with things like intelligent life? You know, in Drake's equation, humans are the intelligent life. But it wasn't that long ago, there was a story of an elephant who basically stamped on the grave of a woman who killed her cub. The elephant danced on the person's grave. Is that a sign of intelligence? A killer whale mourning its child? Intelligence? Ravens using tools? Intelligence? They're all different signs of intelligence. Hell, the fact that we have cats. A cat is an animal that we take care of, feed, pet, groom, clean up after, and it ignores us. That, in my mind, is the apex of intelligence. I mean, who wouldn't want to be pampered and then you don't have to even deal with that person? So isn't that intelligence? How do we, you know, these are important thoughts. And when we talk about intelligent life, you know, we have this tree of life in biology that includes, you know, prokaryotes, eukaryotes, fungi, and so on. And this is millions and millions of species, some single cellular that have not evolved since the beginning of the earth. Because they don't have to. Because they're already the apex of their evolution, at least relative to us, which are newcomers in the evolutionary timescale. And humans are just one tiny fraction, one spike on this big tree. But why is that the only thing that's intelligent? Intelligence, the idea of intelligent life is actually a bad idea because we can't define it. Some people might define it by speech. Some people might define it by using tools. Some people might, but it's always relative to how we behave because the internal assumption that we are intelligent. And in that case, what if we get rid of the idea of number of planets intelligent life and just go with all life in its own way is intelligent? Just because we can't communicate it with it doesn't mean it's not intelligent. How long do civilizations last? Like I said, Drake kind of thought of nuclear war, but it wasn't that long ago when Canada celebrated its 150th anniversary. And, you know, the government celebrated and people threw parties and all this stuff. But this meme kind of propagated around North America, where the coffee shop noted Canada 150, Mi'kmaq 13,000. The Mi'kmaq civilization, not nation, not people, civilization, was around for at least 13,000 years. Why not? The reason we type of civilization as us is because we have this really dumb definition of civilization. We declare civilization as something that is the apex of social and cultural development. So some people will say the Mayan civilization, and then on the same other breath say the Navajo Nation or people, even though they're next door. Why aren't they civilization? And this is kind of problematic. Civilization is not what is most advanced. Western civilization is most advanced, and if you, depending where you go, you can't drink the water. So I think we should be more open. That civilization definition, so therefore the length of time goes up. If we're more open about civilization, then the number of civilizations goes up, or the fraction that produces civilization. Now, in that kind of statement, if the number of planets that go have life that can produce intelligent life goes up, because intelligence is poorly defined, well, that fraction goes up. Then the number of civilizations will go up. The civilizations is poorly defined. You know, civilizations, whether they're indigenous, Western, African, Australian, so on, that they're all civilizations. The idea of having technology that we can communicate with is about us, not about them. And then the length of time goes up. People in Mi'kmaq in North America, tens of thousands of years, relative to the traditional length of time of, say, 100 or 1,000. And so everything is, all these numbers in the Drake equation are going up by orders of magnitude. And if we start thinking about it that way, then the Drake equation goes from having, say, 10 or tens of civilizations to tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of civilizations in our galaxy. We go from a Western perspective of no life or very little to lots everywhere, teeming with life in our galaxy. And I think that's a very big difference. We go from having essentially this kind of dead, sparsely populated galaxy to something where the galaxy is itself full of life. And we're more or less like those little fish that swim around sharks. Except we're on planets swimming around a black hole. And this, I think, will impact, or should impact, how we do things like SETI in the search for life. Today, I would argue that most of the ideas and experiments in the search for life are looking for one of two things. One, they're looking for biosignatures, evidence of at least singular life or of something that at least creates a chemical reaction that cannot be explained by anything but life. So this, you know, Sarah Seeger really kind of led this, and particularly by redefining the Drake equation as a search for biosignatures. So that could be, biosignatures could be methane, carbon dioxide, oxygen, because on Earth we know oxygen was created by life, not the other way around. On the other hand, the other way of searching is looking for technosignatures, looking for evidence that civilizations are building big old things in the sky or trying to communicate or have solar sails, etc. And these are two very different searches. Drake was looking for technosignatures with the radio. Biosignatures are looking basically within the chemicals. And we've, you know, this is the big thing today with the JWST, the telescope that shall not be named. The JWST is looking for these things like carbon dioxide, methane, nitrogen. It's found carbon dioxide. We've proven that just in the commissioning phase. Fortunately, the planet was basically Jupiter. So, you know, not quite the right place, but hey. It's soon that we have the ability to find some evidence of life in the coming years. Just looking at this carbon dioxide signature. Wow, that was really low resolution there, isn't it? It looks way better on my screen. Or as the number of groups came out in what, 20? Ask me, remember a date since the pandemic is impossible. So in the recent past, the detection of phosphine on Venus. I didn't even know what phosphine was before this. Like, I thought it was a drug. And this chemical, you know, detection on Venus of all places is mind-boggling. Even though, you know, maybe it's not real, maybe it was a data artifact, but the detection kind of raised possibilities of life. And so biosignature is kind of straightforward because it's not going to tell us a whole lot about civilizations. It's not going to, you know, we're not going to get the movie Arrival or Contact or Armageddon. Or what's the one with the insects? Independence Day. We're not going to get those, but we're going to look for technosignatures. And there's all kinds of technosignatures. I had to spend a week this summer in Penn State just listening to people talk about technosignatures and realizing, oh my God, it comes in these two forms. One is what we do on Earth projected into space. The other is what we want to do on Earth projected into space. And so we can kind of look at these two forms. Current technosignatures are radio signals, light pollution. It is imaginable that if we mapped the Earth and turned it into a transit signal, that it could be detectable at fractions of a fraction of a percent, the light pollution. These are just two kinds of ideas. Like, what if we extrapolated and you had a world orbiting another star with light pollution? Could we detect sodium as a technosignature? Or listening for radio broadcasts from other civilizations, you know, whatever their version of Gilligan's Island is. And those are kind of some of the current discussions of technosignatures. Then there's, of course, the more more fantastic. Like on the right is a Dyson sphere. This is a theoretical construct that is trying to take advantage of a simple fact. Stars radiate in every direction, and planets intersect a very small fraction of that. So if you want to live efficiently, you'd build an eggshell around the star and it intercepts all that light. Now, that's the simple version. It doesn't really work because radiation pressure would blow it apart. Or if you watch Star Trek, solar activity would destroy it. Because everything, you could boil almost all this back down to Star Trek at some point or another. But, you know, this idea of building Dyson spheres is a very important idea. And something we could look for. This was suggested in 2014 as a solution for the problem of Tabby star. Tabby star was observed with Kepler and was not caught having transits using the automated pipeline because the transits weren't repeating. They are different depths and variable. So citizen scientists found all these kind of up and down dips in Tabby star. So one of the suggestions was it was a Dyson sphere in construction. Because I guess if you live in North America, there's always construction. So eventually you'll see it. Now, this was kind of this, I won't say it was clearly disproven, but there are natural phenomena that could explain this as well, such as a debris disk, massive comets, something like that. The other one on the left is kind of interesting too, is the idea of space lasers. So again, Star Trek or Star Wars, but instead of firing weapons, what if you have a solar sail, but you're far from a star, and the solar sail kind of doesn't work? So what you do is you point a massive laser at it and let it push the solar sail. But that light will reflect so that you get the radiation pressure. Maybe the laser light reflects and we can detect it on Earth. Maybe. We haven't yet. But it would make a good light show. These all exist, but they're mostly kind of speculation. I mean, people have kind of come up with all kinds of ideas, like advanced rockets. I vaguely remember you were telling me about the FRBs, maybe were alien rockets or something like that. Light pollution, radio signals, climate change, nuclear reactions. If an alien species could observe our atmosphere, they would know we effed up. Because there was radioactive uranium in our atmosphere from nuclear tests in the 1950s and 60s. But in other words, when we're saying all these things, what we're asking about is Western civilization. Or in some respects, what would we be looking for if our galaxy was essentially the West or the US or the UK or whatever? And, you know, when I say the West, I'm meaning a very specific thing, Eurocentrism, that kind of idea. But I think what's the issue here is we're not looking for technology. We're looking for technological impact. We're looking for technology that's deviating from nature, from a natural phenomenon. So we're looking for, if we're looking for pollution, we're looking for impact on the world around us. We're not looking for the smelting plant that created the pollution. And that's kind of an interesting challenge. Because if they are out there, can we even see them? And so when I was writing a talk for this SETI conference, I started doodling. I don't doodle, and I'm very bad at it, so you'll get a very sketchy plot. The idea being here, we could think of a species going in two directions. One is how advanced are they going to be? The other is how much impact does their technology have on the world or space around them? And so this is if we're looking out. So Western civilization, we would be going along this path. Biosignatures would be down here. Like, we wouldn't measure a technological impact from biosignatures necessarily. But technosignatures would be up here because we don't measure how advanced they are. We measure how much crap they're spewing. If we're looking for radio signals, we're looking for either targeted emission or leakage, radio leakage. So we're looking for an impact, not an actual advancement. You know, you could be, if you're very advanced and you don't emit a radio or lose radio signal, how would you ever know? And so from our perspective, what we're looking for is somewhere up here. But there could be a whole swath of civilizations in our galaxy we can't detect because they don't impact the space around them in the ways not only in the ways we expect, but in the amount we would expect for the technology. So they could just be hiding and not act, you know, basically camouflage because they're not impacting in the same way. On the other hand, what if other species, other civilizations were looking for us? So we would be, say, here in the middle of this plot. And their ability to detect us, they'd be looking for a certain amount of impact. But that line that looks for the impact could go down with advancement. So really, this line should be kind of sloping downwards over here. So civilizations that have high advancement would be able to find us. But civilizations with high or low impact would find us too and would look at us and be like, what are you doing? And so the point I'm trying to make is maybe when we're looking for civilizations, we're not looking for advanced evolution, technology. We're looking for looters. We're looking for immature civilizations who don't understand what they're doing. Like most of us with most of our society has done in the last century when it comes to pollution. And that's kind of an interesting point, because what would they see? And this maybe talks about the Fermi paradox. This is sort of the flip side of the Drake equation. You know, the Fermi paradox asks, you know, we're 4.5 billion years old. There are stars in our galaxy 10 billions of years old. The galaxy has been around for 10, 11, 12 billion years. So there's like a 5 billion year window where civilizations can grow and advance before we were even a dream, a speck of dust. And if that's true, then there should be civilizations everywhere. Like it's been shown that using simple AI, you know, a civilization could send out probes, the probes could reproduce and go on, and touch every star in a matter of a few million years. So this raises the question, is there anybody out there? And the Fermi paradox is kind of fun because everybody has their own pet idea. And I wish I could remember the guy who wrote the book, but he wrote a book of 150 solutions to the Fermi paradox. So it suffers from a uniqueness problem. But some of the ideas are civilizations blow themselves up before they can actually reach the point of advancing throughout the galaxy. Some of it is they just don't exist. Some of it is the zoo hypothesis, where they look at us like animals in a cage. But I kind of think it's when they look at us, they see something that's unstable. We're impacting our world around us and our space around us in ways that are not sustainable. And so why would they want to interact with us? We would have to depend on them and use them to keep ourselves going. So maybe the solution to Fermi paradox is we're just kind of gross. So having sort of had in my second rant at Waterloo, I'm going to leave you with some kind of conclusions, or at least thoughts. I think thinking about these ideas through indigenous perspectives enriches our understanding of our galaxy and our space and universe and so on. And in this case, for the Drake equation, it's quite valuable because we would actually, I think using indigenous methods, we actually have a very different view of what the Drake equation would predict. One that I think is far more beautiful than there are 10 civilizations in our galaxy kind of a number. And those impacts are important. And I think also should make us reflect on the assumptions and biases we're using to continue the current search with SETI and so on. You know, why are we looking for radio emissions when it's not really efficient? Or why are we looking for light pollution or cellular towers or cellular signals? Things like that. And so I think this is very challenging, should be challenging our perspectives and forcing us to rethink a lot of these issues. And also think it impacts things like the Fermi paradox. Like, I would argue that the galaxy is less colonial than we are. You know, the idea that Independence Day, which aliens come and just and maul us, is unlikely because those kind of species are less likely to survive. So, you know, I think it kind of reframes our place in our galaxy. So, thank you.
Questions for Hilda?
One of the things that kind of sprang to my mind when you were discussing our grossness, and I don't know if I have an actual question about this, but I was just kind of curious how you thought about this in this context, right? From the perspective of very early first single-cell organisms, like oxygen was a really big problem, right? Like them producing all this oxygen was, from their perspective, an enormous pollution and screwing up the planet and making everything gross. So I'm just curious, like, how you, yeah, where would you kind of put that in this scheme?
I'm not sure I quite understand, but I think the idea for the organisms, the single-celled organisms that you mentioned, the anaerobic, that they would see oxygen as pollution. But it's a biological pollution. I mean, we think in that respect, you know, we produce methane. That's a pollution. Cow burps are methane. That's a pollution. But, you know, that's part of nature too. And there are cycles for that. Now, in this case, the cycle went out of hand and species changed and evolved. In the same way the dinosaurs changed and evolved. I don't think that's a problem because I don't know if the anaerobic bacteria chose to do that or try to change their ways or whatever. So I don't really have many thoughts about that being an issue because I think that's part of that was part of the natural evolution. And that's part of it too, right? You know, we're a product of a million years of evolution from whatever our common ancestors were with primates. And in a million years, we'll be something else, assuming we make it that far. Or maybe if we don't make it that far, there'll be something else that maybe takes our place as intelligent life in a million years. But I think that's just part of the nature, and that's the issue. So I guess that, in my mind, that's less about a technosignature being gross and more of a biosignature being, oops.
Are there other questions for the speaker?
Sure. Please.
Yeah. So I think like a lot of the focus from the like from the SETI searches is really focused on what can we detect, and that's, you know, those are we reach for what we also emit because we know how to detect that. And like that plot, I really like the plot that you showed about like actual the impact versus advancement, you know, advancement of this. Yeah, this is great. So there's like stuff that's in that kind of question mark area where we probably, even if it exists, we can't detect it with, you know, the ways that we know how to detect things out in space. I like the idea of, you know, if you broaden your perspective of what constitutes intelligent life or civilizations outside of the Western perspective, that the galaxy is really teeming with life. Is there sort of like a just kind of being content to not know, or like a content to not maybe not detect these things, but kind of, you know that they're out there, or, you know, I don't know exactly how to phrase it, but like we may never, even if things exist in that question mark area, we may just never know that they're there.
Well, I think the idea is currently detectable. As our advancement goes up, this bar should go down. So we have a better chance over time. You know, bigger telescopes, bigger, better resolution, stuff like that. So maybe that's one, time is one element that comes into it. I think part of it is, yeah, being content that we can't discover it is also content. But I think there's a third one, which at risk of defending a certain Harvard professor, I think means we should be thinking a lot more broadly and speculating. Like the idea that Oumuamua was a ship is a great idea. Granted, it was stolen from Kim Stanley Robinson from 20 years ago, 20 years before that, or 30, but it's an idea. And thinking about, I think recognizing that there are things we can't detect, not because they're too much, their impact's too much, but because their impact is small and their technology is high, I think requires us to use imagination. This is one of my bugaboos about building bigger telescopes. Bigger telescope isn't a novel idea. It's just bigger telescope. The telescope itself is a novel idea. And so thinking about how we detect life, maybe using gravitational waves or gravitational lensing or whatever, I think would be kind of cool. But if we're just thinking about us and what's currently detectable, we're probably not going to make it very far beyond radio telescopes and optical SETI.
Are you familiar with Andy Weir's new book?
Is that the one with the
mirror?
Yeah, I read that. That's the linguist one, right? The language one, where there's language communication?
Yeah, but yeah. His premise is that there's an alien civilization that basically grows on Venus.
Yeah.
So they don't use light because their planet is basically opaque. And so we could never detect them because they, like, part of our bias, like you were saying, part of our bias is we look at light.
Mm-hmm.
And we assume that all civilizations will emit light of some sort.
That's true. I mean, it's very hard to detect light pollution on a planet with high optical depth in their atmosphere.
Right.
And you know, this is part of the issue of how we understand habitability. We're only looking for things that look like us because we think that's habitable. The idea that Venus could be habitable is, for lack of a better word, alien to us. And, you know, that's why part of the detection of phosgene was so, I think, popular in the media, because it just seems so fantastic. And that is a huge bias. Like, we're probably never going, even if we, let's say we go to Mars and we find something that's a life form, are we even going to recognize it as life, even if it's a single cell? Just because something has DNA, we may say it's not alive. And so those are issues we have to really contend with, is what are the, how far can we broach our definitions of life? You know, when I teach astrobiology, I love talking about extremophiles, but that's just a misnomer. They're extremophiles because they're not us. I'm sure to a microbe at the bottom of the ocean next to a black smoker, that we're the ugly bags of mostly water. So to use another Star Trek reference.
I have a question.
Yes.
I want to ask about if our universe quantum state is just a superposed state, and when we measure this quantum state, we obtain the only single wave function. I ask about if this collapsing of the superposed wave function represents the disappearance of the intelligent civilizations.
I'm not 100% sure I caught all that question, but I think you're asking about the superposition of quantum states representing divergent civilizations?
The disappearance of the intelligent civilizations from our universe.
My universe. Yeah, to be perfectly honest with you, when it comes to life beyond our universe, I kind of stop because A, I'm not that smart, and B, we have no chance of we have less chance of detecting that. So I don't really think I have as much ability to answer that question on the spot. It was something I have to sit with and really think about, particularly since it's been a while since I thought of a superposition of quantum states. So, but is there anything?
I mean, the other civilizations may be a quantum world.
Sorry, what was that last word?
A quantum world.
Quantum?
World.
Quantum world.
Maybe I can't make any comment about quantum worlds.
This question seems a bit off topic, so let's move on. There are more questions for Hilda? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.